Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field. Okay, welcome to another episode of BTK, and it's actually a very big thrill to have this evening's guest on, and that's Dr. Mark Malangoni. And as a lot of you out there know, that he is the Associate Executive Director for the American Board of Surgery, and more importantly, a longtime Cleveland and Shaker Heights, Ohio native. So, Dr. Malangoni, thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Thanks for asking me, Scott. I really appreciate it.
So what we really wanted to do is we're going to explore a little bit about the boards and, you know, maybe kind of debunk some of the myths about the boards and talk a little bit about the importance about the boards. But first, sir, for those of you who don't know your background, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you train? Obviously, you're a surgeon. And how did you get to the point? Take me up until Cleveland first. Let's go there.
All right. Well, I was born in Northwest Indiana, in what's typically referred to as the region by the people that live there and the people that don't. Did all my education in Indiana, first at IU down in Bloomington, and then medical school up in Indianapolis. And my training continued in Indianapolis at Indiana University. And then when I finished training, I took a job in Milwaukee at the Medical College of Wisconsin and was there for just about 4 years. It was a great initial job, really had a lot of opportunities to advance my own education and gain some experience that went beyond residency. Then after that, I moved to the University of Louisville and stayed there for about 6 years. Another great experience, worked with some absolutely spectacular people, just icons of surgery in the department at that time, and it was a real pleasure. It's just amazing. When you go someplace, you think you know something. When you get there and you find out that you learn something new anywhere that you go, and that was certainly my experience at Louisville. And then following that, I moved to Cleveland.
So tell us a little bit about, your time at Cleveland at Metro, and, you know, you spent a long time, just chairing that department, and a little bit about that stage of your career.
So I moved to Cleveland in 1990 and was there as chair for about 21 years. It was a great opportunity to work in a first-class residency program, a good hospital, a county hospital, and I always had a spot in my heart for indigent patient care, and certainly got the opportunity to do that, as well as to really advance some of my other interests in shock and resuscitation and treatment of abdominal injuries. So the whole trauma aspect and a lot of surgical critical care, a great opportunity to expand a department that had a very solid history over, you know, the past 40 or 50 years before I got there, got to work with some great people and to work with some fantastic residents in my time there.
Well, sir, I guess stepping back just a little bit, we all want to know how you first became involved in the American Board of Surgery. Like, what got you interested in joining?
Well, my first encounter was I passed my boards.
That's yeah, true. I guess that's all.
That was a wonderful encounter. After that, I'm trying to think. It was probably about 7 or so years into practice after residency where I had the opportunity to be an associate examiner for the board. So finally got to sit on that other side of the table and to ask questions rather than to answer questions. And I had the opportunity to do that a few times before I was elected as a director of the American Board of Surgery and was an active director for 7 years, culminating in becoming chair of the board in 2002-2003. And then, you know, when that year ends, the lifeline is cut, and very quickly you go back to doing everything else, and you realize you've got a good month of your life that you were devoting to board activities every year. You get that month back. And so you go through a little bit of withdrawal, but you quickly find something else to fill the time. And I still examined as a senior director of the board after my time as a active director ended. And then about 6 years ago, an opportunity arose to join the board as an associate executive director. There was some change going on at that time. The ABS was interested in two things that fit me very well, at least, and that was those were maintenance of certification, which was had been in effect for about 5 years, but really still needed some parameters put around it and more framework put around it. And also the SCORE project. And the person, Dick Bell, who was leading the SCORE project at that time, was retiring from the board, and they were looking for someone to take over that role. So both of those things involve education, and that's really my love, is surgical education. So I thought it was just an absolute fantastic opportunity, and I was fortunate enough to be selected.
So as you came into this particular role, I mean, one of the things we really want to get into tonight is talking a little bit about the board process itself, maybe towards the end, debunk some of the myths about that. So let's talk first about the board. We have everybody from medical students and residents all the way up to chair departments follow us on Behind the Knife. And for those who obviously are at the early part of their learning curve, can you just walk us through a little bit about the board process, about, you know, the written orals, what happens, you know, along those lines, and what it takes to become a board certified surgeon, and who is eligible for that?
Well, that's a great question, Scott. Let me start by addressing what it means to be board certified, because I think that's really important. Not everybody becomes board certified, but probably 95% or so of surgeons, certainly in general surgeons, and perhaps more so in some of the other specialties under the ABS, are board certified. And so you get to be board certified by graduating from an approved medical school and doing a residency that is ACGME accredited. And in the United States, all of the surgery residencies are ACGME accredited. So that's the starting point. And then there's some other requirements along the way as that relate to the training that you have to do in a certain number of cases and certain experiences and some ancillary courses like the Advanced Trauma Life Support course and ACLS that you have to take and pass at one point. You know, once you get all of that done and you finish your residency and your program director has attested and says that you're a good person and, you know, you have professional characteristics that are acceptable and ethical characteristics that are acceptable, then you have the opportunity to become board certified. And that then involves first applying for and passing a written examination, which we call the qualifying examination. And that's given once a year now in beginning in July, about 3 weeks after a residency's end. If you are successful at passing that written examination, then you're eligible for the next step, which is the oral exam or the certifying examination. Which is given multiple times across a given year. And that's the final step towards board certification. So that's what it means. Not everyone, as I mentioned earlier, not everyone is board certified. most surgeons now, and I would say most physicians now, choose to become board certified in whatever specialty they practice, just because it reflects a higher standard of achievement than physicians who are not board certified. And these boards, by the way, are all connected under the aegis of a parent group called the American Board of Medical Specialties. And that group sets the standards for certification, very broad standards for certification, that all boards must follow. And there are certain commonalities there, but each board has clearly has their individual characteristics that are unique to what they do in their particular profession.
Well, you did talk about the written and the oral boards. Let's say you take them and you fail the first time. I mean, what is the typical pass-fail rate for both the written and oral boards, and what do you do if you fail?
Sure. That's a common question that comes up, and a good one. So the pass rate on the board exams can be expressed in two ways. One is an overall pass rate, and that's what you tend to see expressed most of the time, and that tends to be a fail rate of just slightly more than 20%. It can be slightly higher than that some years, slightly lower others. Probably the more important way to express it is for people that take the board exam for the first time. And the fail rate for those individuals is actually in the low to mid teens. So it's much less than the overall pass rate, or the overall fail rate, excuse me. And that's really because you don't have any real control over how many individuals in a given year take the boards for a second time or a third time. And the fail rate for retakers is higher than it is for first-time takers. So I always think that first-time taker pass rate is probably the better indicator of how successful we are at training people than necessarily what the overall pass rate is.
When you have that situation, though, let's say you're one of the unfortunate people who does unfortunately fail their boards, how do you find out? Do you get a call from the board? Do you get any feedback? Do you know where you went wrong? And what would you say to, we have a lot of people out there and, that are getting very nervous about this entire process and looking up to it. And what do they do? What do you recommend?
Yeah, so the results of the oral examination are available this year a little bit later than they had been in the past because we've switched to a different system. And so we have some internal processes that we want to make sure are working well before we release the information, because everyone finds out at once. So we want to be absolutely sure that the results are accurate. It would be a tragedy to give somebody an incorrect result. So we do a lot of checking and double checking and triple checking to make certain that all of these results are accurate and well done. So right now, when the results are available, all the candidates that took the exam at a given site will get an email that tells them the results are available. And then they go to the American Board of Surgery website, which is www.absurgery.org. Everybody can log in. Everyone's got their own account. It's secure. And then that's when they find out their results, whether they passed or failed. And that's all done, as I said, simultaneously for all examinees.
Somebody does fail, though, in this particular situation. Is there a maximum number of times that you can fail? You mentioned several different repeat takers. Is that different from the orals to the writtens?
So the rule about how many times you can take an exam is set by that parent body, the American Board of Medical Specialties. And and you have 7 years to achieve board certification. So individual boards can select how they want to parse that out. And what we've decided to do at the American Board of Surgery is that you have 4 tries in 4 years to pass the written exam. And if you do that, then you have three tries in 3 years to pass the oral exam. Now, remember, with that written exam, it's only given once a year. So if you do fail the written exam, you have to wait a year automatically. The oral exams are given five times a year. However, we only guarantee people one opportunity in a given year. And by and large, it's very rare that we have more slots available than there are requests by candidates to take that exam once a year. So it's really uncommon, almost rare, to be able to have two opportunities in a given year. So that's, I wouldn't have anybody, no one should expect that. That would be above and beyond. You do have three chances in 3 years. If you choose not to take an exam in a given year once you're eligible, that counts against you. So it's not a fail, but it's an opportunity that's lost. And so if you don't take those opportunities, they go away. So, for instance, if you put off that examination the first 2 years, and it's now, you know, that third year after which you became eligible, you've only got that one final try at it. You don't have an additional, two tries.
Well, sir, one question that comes up with when you're in the residency program, specifically like myself, is like, why do general surgeons do oral boards? Some other medical specialties, such as orthopedics and radiology, they submit a case log, or in radiology, they eliminated the oral certification exam. Why do you think it's important that we continue to do an oral board scenarios?
Yeah, most of the surgical boards do an oral exam. Off the top of my head, I can't think of one of the surgical boards that does not do an oral exam. That's not true, as you've stated, for the non-surgical boards. There's quite a variability there. And I think as you look at all of the 24 boards under the realm of ABMS, it's about 50-50 as to which boards do oral exams and which do not. And of the boards that do the oral exam, they all do it a little differently. You're correct. With orthopedics, you submit your case log after a period of time in practice, and then they select for you which area you get examined in. You do have some choices, but it has to correlate with what you do in practice. We don't do it that way. We provide a very general examination. We do it earlier than many of the other surgical boards they often require more time in practice than we do. We basically say once you've passed that written examination and you've completed your residency, you're eligible to take the oral exam and become board certified. So it's a little quicker path through the ABS than it is through some of the other surgical boards.
So one of the things that comes up oftentimes is really there is a lot of kind of mystery and stigmatism associated with that rite of passage, if you will. I've heard it said that, you know, people, they know how to be surgeons. They go through a whole six-year residency, and a part of this process boils down to three 30-minute sessions associated with some arbitrary cases that maybe they don't do this, or maybe they never did a Whipple or a trisegmentectomy or what you name the procedure. What do you say about those people? And really, could you talk a little bit about the boards from the examiner, kind of a part two to that? Talk about the boards from an examiner point of view. How fair is it? What lengths do you go to essentially to make it be a fair examination? And is there really a specified pass cut rate that you're looking for, that regardless how people do, is there a curve?
Those are all great questions. So let me try and address them one at a time. And if I miss one, tell me, and we'll come back to it. So fairness. So we try to provide as much information we can to the candidates about what's going to be on the exam. And the exam basically will cover the totality of the SCORE general surgery curriculum. And all of our exams now are based off of that curriculum, whether it be the written exam, the in-training exam, the oral exam, or the maintenance of certification exam. The weighting of the exams differs, but they're all based on that curriculum. So it's really important for the candidates to be very familiar with and well-versed in the core elements of that curriculum, whether it be core diseases and conditions or core operations. So that's the bulk of the examination. There are questions and scenarios that are involved with the more advanced modules in the SCORE curriculum and the advanced operations in the SCORE curriculum. But they're certainly much less commonly asked than the core curriculum questions are. So we think that's fair. We look at the oral examination as really testing people on what they should have learned in residency. And so that's a much broader field than you might learn in practice. Now, you're going to, as a resident, you're going to do some things that you may never choose to do in practice, and that's okay. You have that opportunity once you go out, and you can, you know, select whatever area you want to practice in, and you may choose to go on and do further training and focus in that area of additional training, and hence not do the totality of general surgery. But for that initial examination, you know, we certify individuals in general surgery, and we want to make certain that they're capable of passing the exam. The exam itself is really meant to assess some things that we can't assess very well on a written test. So written tests are great to determine whether someone has a basic knowledge of different situations, but it's much more limited in an ability to find out if individuals are good at decision-making, at reacting to changing situations, at dealing with complications, and describing the key steps of operations, et cetera. And that's what the certifying exam or oral exam is meant to test. So it really does test different aspects of what you do in practice than just your base of knowledge. The other question you asked about was what do you do if you fail? Was that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So, obviously that most people fail the examination, they start out, obviously they're disappointed, and many times they start out angry. And you know, it takes a while to get through that and get through the disappointment. And then, you know, you need to pick it up and move on and recognize that, you may not have passed that particular time, but you're going to have additional chances to do so. I might add that even though we talked earlier about a fail rate for first-time takers that's in the low to mid-teens, individual in that three-year window of opportunity you have to pass the certifying examination, about 95% of people who apply for that certifying examination eventually pass in those three tries. So I really think that's important for people to know, so you know they don't become, you know, totally deflated by the fact that they may have failed the first time. You asked about feedback. We don't give specific feedback on performance on the exam. That used to be done. We ended that practice about a decade ago. And the reason for it was that it usually turned into more of an argument than it was a learning opportunity for people. And it became an issue of, you know, who said what, and no, people would argue about what they answered and how that differed from what the examiner said, et cetera. So we just basically ended that and looked at it more from the point of view of, you know, if you take the exam again, it's really unlikely you're going to get asked about the same scenarios you got asked the time before. So giving particular feedback about what you missed before probably isn't going to help you on a subsequent examination.
So, and then is there a traditional cut rate? Is there a, can everybody pass? And granted, not everybody does, but let's say in an ideal world, would the American Board of Surgery be fine if everybody passed?
We would love it if everybody passed, because when you pass that examination, it's really a reflection not only on you as an individual and the accomplishment that you've earned in passing that examination, but it reflects favorably on your program, on your faculty, on your fellow residents. So we love it when people pass. And yes, everyone can pass the examination. I might add that that hasn't happened yet, but on the other hand, you know, there is no fixed failure rate. And I think that's important for people to know as well.
Well, I know some, like many certifying exams out there, there's a lot of review courses and online test banks, et cetera. What are your thoughts on the review courses that they have out there for the oral boards, even though they're not really associated with the American Board of Surgery at all?
Yeah, there are a variety of review courses, and there's a lot of variability, I think, within the review courses. Now, I'm saying that as someone who hasn't taken any of those review courses, so I really can't speak to it as an insider. We did a study a few years ago and published it about whether or not there was a correlation between passing the certifying examination and taking the review course, and at that time we found out that there was not. Now, we're continuing to collect information about that, and we hope that after this year, we'll have a much greater number of observations, and we can perhaps draw some more definitive conclusions than we could after that first year's set of exams. So I think the question is, you know, should you take the course or not? You know, about what I always ask the examinees when I'm doing the orientation for them, for the oral examination, you know, how many of them have taken a review course? And usually it's about 80% or so, you know, will raise their hand and they have, and they tend to take a whole variety of courses. And I think some of them are, you know, they're the type A personality that they're going to do everything in their power to make sure they pass that exam. And, you know, they probably not only have done a review course, but they probably have done mock oral boards, and they probably have you know, looked at review books in preparation for the exam, as well as just studying and being attentive during the course of their residency. And then there are other people that, you know, may take that examination because they feel that they need help with the examination scenario. So not so much the answers, but, you know, the style of the examination, the back and forth that goes on in questioning between the examiners and the examinee. And they may need just some help in familiarizing themselves with that particular process. That can also be done well through mock oral boards. You know, that's what some of the board review courses do, is they put forth that they're really trying to encounter some sort of an example that they can hopefully build on and learn from. So that may be the benefit to those particular individuals. And then there are probably some other people that take it that are just trying to cram at the end. And those are the people I worry most about, because, you know, this is something that you really learn from your entire residency training experience. And if you think you can cram it all in at the end and you really haven't paid attention in your training as you've gone along, you're probably not going to do well no matter what you do in preparation.
So one of the things we're trying to do here is debunk some of the myths. So without going into specific questions, walk me through the days. So I'm a candidate. I'm going to get up there. Take me a little bit about how my day is kind of going to pan out. And then take a behind the scenes look into that room. What is the room like? How's it set up? What's this back and forth you're talking about, the different rooms? And my understanding is that people, some of the examiners meet in between cases. Do they discuss my performance if I'm a test taker, and if it can somebody convince the others to fail me if I thought I had a pretty good room?
Good question, Scott. So you take three exams in a row. Each exam is about 30 minutes. It turns out to be a little less than that because you have to travel from one room to the next to get to your other examinations. So it's about an hour and a half, and it goes extremely quickly for the candidates. So the setting when they walk into the room is there are two examiners in the room. They're both board-certified surgeons. One is a senior director or an active director of the board. The other is an associate examiner who's been in practice at least 5 years, oftentimes has done the examination before with other candidates, and is someone that's known for their reputation either in practice or education or both. So the scenarios that once in the room, you're usually asked about four different patient scenarios. It varies at each exam. The scenarios are not the same from one site to the next. There is some variability that goes on. And the examiners will ask you a whole series of questions that involve that particular scenario. So it's usually a case presentation to begin with, and then a more in-depth exploration into management and understanding of the situation that you're given initially, and then perhaps you may be given a complication or maybe asked, well, if the situation changed, would you react differently? You may be asked about testing, you know, what tests would you get? And I think there the examiners are trying to probe, well, do you know the basic tests that you should get in a particular scenario? We also want to make sure that you don't overtest. You know, that can be bad too. So that shotgun approach isn't necessarily the best approach to take during the examination. And what the examiners are really trying to get from the candidates is what are you doing in as you would normally encounter this in your practice? You know, and this is not meant to be a tricky situation or a gotcha type of case, but it's more of, you know, here it is, it's a typical thing that you might encounter on a given day. And how are you going to handle it? You know, how would you work the patient up? How would you deal with a very urgent situation? You know, I always tell the candidates, you know, there are only four questions on the exam. You know, what would you do? Why do you do it? How do you do it? And when do you do it? And that's pretty much the examination.
Well, I definitely think that's some great advice. One of the things I can think of myself when I eventually do take the oral boards, I'll be trying to war game it. So is there any difference between like if I had a morning session or an afternoon session or maybe a Monday session versus a Wednesday session? Is there a difference in terms of pass-fail rates or test toughness?
Well, there isn't a difference. So there's no advantage or disadvantage to being in a morning or afternoon session or one day of the week as opposed to another. There's always a bit of a sigh when an individual shows up for the orientation session and finds out that they're in the second group and they've got a couple of hours before their test would start. But we can only examine so many candidates at a time. So that's always going to happen.
Let's jump ahead a little bit to away from the actual examination itself and talk a little bit more of the other aspect of the board. Can we talk a little bit about MOC, why it's important to stay up in that, talk about recertification process? Is that locked in? Are we going to see some changes in that? And why is it important for today's surgeons to maintain their maintenance of certification?
Yeah, let me go back and provide a little historical bit of importance. And that is the American Board of Surgery was the second board to initiate a recertification exam, and that was done in 1976. So maintaining your certification by taking a repeat examination every 10 years has been around now for four decades. So as surgeons, we've had a long time experience with this. And the only board that has had a longer experience than we have is family medicine. So general surgeons and vascular surgeons and pediatric surgeons and critical care surgeons, et cetera, have all been doing this for a long time. What happened a little more than a decade ago was that the concept of maintenance of certification came to pass. And what that involved was, in addition to taking that exam and checking on professional references, and making certain that people have an active license and didn't have any sanctions against them in any of the states they practiced, et cetera, that was already being done with that 10-year examination. So what got added was a requirement for continuous medical education, which is also called lifelong learning self-assessment, or referred to as part two of the four parts of maintenance of certification, and the requirement that you participate in some sort of a practice improvement or quality improvement program, the so-called part four component of MOC. So when MOC came to pass, you know, we were pretty much the American Board of Surgery and its diplomates were already had a large experience with this. So adding on the CME, which, by the way, is required to have a license in nearly all of the states, so that was really not an additional burden. The only thing that was different was adding on that practice assessment piece. And people can satisfy that in a variety of ways. You could do it if your hospital participates in a national quality improvement program like NISQIP, or bariatric surgery has a quality improvement program. Trauma has TQIP. Pediatric surgery has a program. The vascular surgeons have a national registry. So there are a whole lot of these that are around that people participate in, and that's one way to satisfy that Part 4 requirement. And then for people that don't have something like that available to them, there are some other means. There's the ABMS has what's called the multi-specialty portfolio program, which hospitals and institutions and sometimes states or local hospital consortia will subscribe to, and you can get your Part 4 requirement met that way. Or you may just be involved in some quality improvement program at your local hospital. And all of those things count. So what we try to do, what guides us having these requirements, is to recognize that it's important for people to do some of these things and to maintain that higher level of care that you have in certification. But the intention here is not to add a lot of extra work. We try to look at things that satisfy these requirements and are done in the course of your normal practice, or are done in the course of maintaining your licensure in a state. So that's sort of the philosophy that guides us in keeping with MOC. I would say that right now about 95% of our diplomates are participating in MOC. We still have a group of probably a few hundred ABS diplomates that haven't gotten into the cycle yet of being required to participate in MOC. But that will happen by the end of next year. So by then, everybody will be either in MOC, or they may choose not to be in MOC. That's up to them. It's a voluntary program.
Sir, the one question I had in my mind wondering a little bit, jumping back a little bit, if you decided not to get board certified or not maintain your MOC, does this have legal ramifications in your practice in a setting of complications? Or are you less protected that way? The lawyer's going to jump all over you?
Well, I can't give you a legal opinion about that. Okay. Most hospitals in the United States now require board certification in order to be on the hospital staff. And so that's probably the biggest driver for individuals to become board certified initially and to maintain that board certification once they get it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then another question I was thinking of is, how has the American Board of Surgery evolved since you first got involved, you know, all those years ago? What is it maybe the goals or the focus of the board has changed a little bit?
You know, the main the main goal of the board has always been to certify individuals in the various disciplines of surgery covered by the ABS. And I mentioned those before, general surgery, pediatrics, surgical critical care, vascular, and the like. And that has not changed. What I think has changed over time are the processes by which we do that. So since I started with the board now 20 years ago as an initial director, MOC didn't exist at that time. So MOC was developed over that period of time, and I was actually fortunate enough to be at some of those early meetings when the framework was being constructed. And so it's been a lot of fun to see that evolve over time and to see it go to where it is now. I think the other thing that's changed is the rigor of our oral examination. As I think back to my oral exam, it's, you know, there were a lot of myths about what the oral exam was like. And some of those things were not necessarily myths. They were actually truisms. So it was structured very differently. It was a lot of times it was extremely open-ended. The examiners, you know, at times could ask anything they wanted. It's not like that anymore. The exam is very structured. The questions that the examiners asked are set. We do a lot of psychometric analysis of performance of the examinees on questions so that we understand which scenarios are more difficult than others and which ones the candidates have more trouble with. And that helps us structure an exam across those five cities that are used each year. We try to structure an examination that if you went from exam to exam, even though the questions are different, the degree of difficulty is not going to differ that much. So all of those things keep evolving every year, you know, in an attempt to just improve the examination process.
And so wrapping up, you know, again, one of our major goals here was to try to debunk any myths surrounding this. So in your mind, what's the largest myth that surrounds the board process itself?
I think for the residents coming out into practice initially, it's that concern that, you know, our goal is not to pass people on the exam. Our goal is to fail people. And that's clearly not the case. What's really important to us is that we construct fair examinations. And we try our best to make certain that the questions that people are being asked are, you know, are applicable to what they're going to encounter in a real life situation and not be, you know, some sort of a crazy red herring that, you know, no one is ever going to see in their lifetime. So I think that's probably the biggest myth that's out there. And I think the other myth that's out there is that the people that come up with these ideas are a bunch of individuals who are highly academic and never see patients and have no idea, you know, what it's like to treat somebody in a real practice. So I think nothing could be further from the truth. While many of our directors come from institutions that have an academic affiliation, we do have at-large members that we specifically look to get surgeons who are in community practice. We like them, obviously, to have some experience with education, whether it's medical students or residents, but, you know, certainly they're generally not at university hospitals. They're at other institutions. And we have a public member to try and keep us on the straight and narrow to make certain we maintain our commitment to the public trust, that we are certifying individuals that are safe and competent to practice surgery.
Well, Dr. Malangoni, we do appreciate you taking your time today to work through debunking some of the oral board myths. But before you go, we do have one question for you. We ask a lot of our guests, and if you could go back in time and see yourself on the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
pay attention. You know, and this may, I say that, and it probably relates to a lot of what we've been talking about this evening, and that is, chair of the Department of Surgery, when I asked him one time, you know, what do I need to do to, eventually get board certified? And his answer was very simple. He said, just come to the conferences and pay attention. And I thought it was just absolutely terrific advice, in the course of that 5 years of training, you're gonna learn a lot of this stuff. You just have to pay attention.
Well, sir, we can't thank you enough for taking the time out, and on behalf of the American Board of Surgery and on behalf of all of our listeners at Behind the Knife, we truly appreciate you walking us through these different scenarios and kind of educate us in debunking some of those myths around not only the oral board process, but the board itself and the importance of the board. And again, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Until next time, dominate the day.